is Wendy, and I have the pleasure of introducing Glenn Rumble. Glenn was called to the Bar of Ontario in 1989, and from there served as counsel in a leading Bay Street law firm. He served as general counsel to a venture capital investment firm and managed several Toronto-based companies before co-founding Ross Rumble, which is a general-purpose firm which focuses on small to mid-size organizations. Glenn's also a musician, budding novelist, yoga enthusiast, and a self-professed convert to holistic nutrition. He joined the CAMMP as a founding director in 2008, and he also serves as our counsel and a frequent contributor to The Voice. So we're so pleased that you were able to make time for us today.
Thank you. This is based on a seminar that I do every quarter with the Toronto Business Development Centre, which is a re-education program co-founded with the federal government to help new entrepreneurs start businesses. And it's kind of a scaled-back version because they have a slightly different emphasis than you do. The talk is divided into two halves. First is business law fundamentals, and I think that's what was advertised. And in that area, I'm going to look a little bit about some of the key questions that I find people always have, which is incorporations, trademarks, and protecting my intellectual property, be it the things that you write for your clients or whatever. And the second area is dealing with specifics of the nutritionist practice in Ontario primarily, but I pretty well read all the regs for across Canada, so if anyone has any questions about other provinces, I don't suspect you will since we're all from Ontario in this room right now, but if you do, feel free to ask me and I may just know the answer to it. All right, so business law fundamentals. If you go to it's the third page of your handout, the point A, there are basically five main ways that businesses are structured in Ontario. Whenever you're setting up a new business, it's useful to know this, and you can decide what's the best structure for you. I'll primarily talk about corporations, but the main ones that you hear about are something called a sole proprietorship, and you have a partnership, you have joint ventures, business trusts, and, of course, corporations. The big three that would touch most people's lives are sole proprietorships, general partnerships, and corporations. A sole proprietorship is really nothing more. It's what you do if you sell, when you're a babysitter, you're a sole proprietor, if you ever did that. If you ever shoveled snow as a kid, you're a sole proprietor. It's basically a business that you're running in your own name with no formal structure around you, and you just own it, operate it, provide the service or the product to people. And that's that. It's the simplest way anyone can undertake a business. And what I've done is I've set the pros and cons if you're looking at that for your business model. The pros of a sole proprietorship, as I said, very, very simple. Basically, it exists the moment you start breathing and providing a service. There are some registrations perhaps involved. If I have GST there, it should be HST now, I guess. For HST or other kinds of government licenses that you may need, you may have to apply for. But the other big pro is that your income and expenses are realized personally. And if you're running a business now out of your house, you may appreciate this. But when it's in your own name, every single cent, the seminar, for example, is an expense, and you write it off your income from all sources, which is nice. You write off a portion of your rent if you're renting, a portion of your mortgage if you're not, all your utilities. And that's all realized personally, written off personally, which is really nice. So it's very good from the tax side. The big downsides of sole proprietorships, basically there's three. One is personal liability, because it's just you carrying on business. You're the one that's liable to everyone that you do business with, which means all your personal assets are on the line for any mistakes and problems. If you do have a kind of business where you're going to have employees, say you're setting up a clinic of some kind, It's a little tougher to incent people with profit sharing and with a piece of the action if you want to bring in someone really good and give them a portion of the business to incent them, because you don't have the structure around you to do that. And the other con is if you have very good financial year, you can't shelter any of your money. So everything is taxed in the year, in the calendar year in which it's realized. So other structures have an ability to structure to shelter your money. So that's a sole proprietorship. Say the simplest thing. It's the way many, many people carry on business. A partnership, I won't spend too much time on. A partnership, just think of, it's an oxymoron. It's two sole proprietors carrying on business together. So it has all the same pluses and minuses of a sole proprietorship with one additional minus, and that is when someone is your business partner, they can bind you to a contract without your knowledge or presence. So if you, when you're in partnership and your partner signs a lease on behalf of your partnership, the partnership's responsible because you're sole proprietors. Both of your assets are on the line for it. So you only ever want to have a partnership when you really know what you're doing and you're getting involved with someone that you really like. People lapse into partnerships all the time without even realizing it, because you don't need a written agreement for a partnership. If I look at you and just say, you know, let's go into business together, we'll split it 50-50, and you say, yes, we have a partnership, and everything, you can bind me, I can bind you to contractual commitments. It's quite significant, and as I say, it doesn't have to be in writing. Which brings us to corporations. How many of you are going to be having your own practice? I assume at least a couple. Yeah? Okay, good, good. Have you thought about incorporating at all? Has anyone suggested it to you? Are you incorporated?
No, I thought about it.
All right, well, we'll go through it. And please ask me all the questions you want. I've been doing this for like almost 30 years now. And so basically, you've got 2 hours of someone who's been doing this for 30 years and charges out like $400 an hour at your disposal for $20, so or whatever the fee was here. So please, lots of questions. Okay, a corporation. A corporation, I had a professor at law school and he used to say, a corporation is a blob, and he used to say it like that. Draw a circle. So that's what a corporation is. And then he would draw these funny little hands on it, and then feet. And put a big thing here. And that's what a corporation is. Looks like that guy, what's that monster movie? You know, the one, the kids movie? Yeah. Monsters, Inc. Looks like the little guy in Monsters, Inc. But this is really what a corporation is. A corporation is a legal person at law. It can do everything a human being can do except get married and have children. Otherwise, and vote. So three things a corporation can't do. Otherwise, a corporation does absolutely everything that we can do. What these things are on it, this is actually the brain, and that's the board of directors of the corporation. And a board of directors is someone that they're charged with running the affairs of the company. They meet intermittently, and they provide the big general guidance for the business. Down here you have the hands, and we'll call one arm the officers. That's like the president, the CEO, the chief financial officer. And the other arm will be the employees. They basically do whatever the board of directors of the brain tells them to do. And then down here for the legs, we have the shareholders, because they own the thing, so they're kind of holding it up. So corporations, a legal entity, just like you and I are, can do everything we can do except those three things. It's made up of a board of directors, which is the brain. It has employees and officers, which actually carry out the commands of the brain, and it's owned by shareholders. That's what a corporation
really
is. What's that?
It's like really it. Good. I like that.
Thank you.
Yeah, that works.
Now, in large companies, you know, if we're talking IBM, of course, you know, or RIM or something, the board of directors might be, you know, 25 middle-aged men and women who all make millions of dollars a year, and they meet once, you know, once every 2 quarters in a tax haven somewhere, and establish policy. I'm being a bit facetious, but it's a fairly remote kind of body, and the officers actually run everything, and they're the ones making all the big decisions. And the kind of company that you will have, you quite likely would be all three. So, you know, you may be the sole director of the company. You'll be the only officer. Those are required at law. You'll be the sole employee of the business, and you'll also own the shares. So you will, in effect, be every element here. It doesn't require anyone else. One person can be all three. And you'll also have the benefit of being an alternative, you'll have an alter ego, your corporate status. So with that in mind, there's a list of pros and cons on why someone may want to incorporate. The biggest thing for a corporation, and I'll discuss it more a little bit later, it is limited personal liability. The shareholders, they own the business, and in theory, they inject the initial cash into the business. Once they do, so if I set up a company for you, and your company needs $1,000 to start off, you put $1,000 in the bank account, that's all the money the shareholders have at risk, in my example, $1,000. If the company goes bankrupt, that's all they lose. If someone sues the company, that's all they lose. So that's the advantage. It's limited liability. The directors can sometimes be made liable for things. I'll get to that in a minute. The office and employees can sometimes, although very rarely, be liable for things. But the only thing that the corporation ever has at risk is the money that's inside of it. So its profits, some, you know, the properties that it owns will be at risk. But the shareholder's house down here is not at risk. Their car is not at risk. Their cottage, you know, their RSPs, all their personal assets are not at risk, only that $1,000. So that's a huge benefit of incorporating. Corporation also has with it certain flexibilities for dealing with employees and others. Because you have shareholders, if you want to make your corporation a three-legged beast or a four-legged beast, you just add on more shareholders, and you have more people owning it and propping it up. And so you can invite in partners very easily and give them a piece of the pie, if you will, a division of the profits. One of the best things about a corporation is a lower tax rate. Because the government wants to encourage business, they tax the first $400,000 of corporate profits at a lower rate than you and I pay on our personal income. So you remember when I said a sole proprietor, one of the advantages is, you know, all your expenses you realize personally, and but you also pay all the taxes personally. In a company, if the company has $100,000 profit, it'll only pay about 20% in taxes. So it'll keep around $80,000 to reinvest. If you or I earned that $100,000, we probably would pay, you know, somewhere around 40%, you know, fully integrated kind of tax on it. So we would only have about $60,000 left to invest. So there's a benefit to keeping the money in the corporation. So it has a lower tax bracket. Now, if you need that, I don't want to get too complicated, but of course, if you're the sole employee and you have to pay it out to yourself anyway, it all comes out in the wash and you know further ahead. But if you have a profitable year, like my law practice is a professional corporation, because if we have a good year, we keep money that we don't need to live on that year. We leave it in the company and we invest it through our professional corporation. And we pay less tax on it, and then we accumulate investments within our corporation. So that's one of the, you know, one of the benefits in the longer term planning. You can do family and estate planning with the corporation. You know, you can get your kids involved as shareholders and help shelter some profits with them and pass taxes on to them or your spouse. In a lot of industries, corporations just give you credibility. People like to deal with companies. When I was Glenn Rumble, barrister and solicitor, I maybe didn't have the same credibility as Ross Rumble, professional corporation. Just sounds better. So a lot of people just give you more credibility because you are incorporated. Another great thing about it, if you're setting up a clinic or something and you want to sell it, so you're going to sell this corporation, the first $750,000 in capital gains, which is profit on the sale, is tax-free. You realize that personally, you're going to pay about 25% tax on capital gains. So there's a big advantage there. The government did that to encourage small businesses to invest and sell. So there's a lot of benefits to a corporation. So what's the downside of incorporating? One of the downsides, you know, is cost. Often when you're setting up a business, you don't have a lot of money, and incorporating a company will probably cost anywhere from $1,000 to $1,200. About $400 of that is government fees, and the rest would be the fees of your agent or lawyer or accountant, whoever doing it. You can do them online. The problem is, you don't know what you don't know. And I have yet to have a client come to me who did one of the online packages who got it right. They always make mistakes because there's lots of rules. Yes?
Let's say to do it through you, mm-hmm. How long will that take? What is the length of time?
In an emergency, when I'm doing a transaction, I can have you incorporated and organized in one day because you can file everything online. In ordinary course, when it's non-emergency, usually about a week, you know, before we go back and forth in the name a few times, maybe 2 weeks at best. When you go to a lawyer or anybody, feel free to negotiate fees would always be my recommendation. Don't just take what they tell you. Tell them I have $1,200 and that's that. I had a friend that did that filing a patent. He asked for advice. They said, go to a patent agent, say you want to spend this much money, you're not going to spend a penny over. And people want business and they'll do it. But because it's about $400 in government fees, there's not a lot of latitude on the legal side for cutting fees. But it shouldn't be much more than that. The biggest problem in a company, we'll get to that in a few minutes, is names. You know, there are so many corporations out there, almost every name in the book that you can think of is being used by somebody. So it may take you a couple of shots to find a name that runs clean and is worth having. So you've got the cost as a downside. The other cost associated with it is it's a separate legal person, which means it does have separate income tax to pay at a lower rate, mind you. But that means each year you have two sets of books to do, your personal books and the corporate books, two sets if you use an accountant, you know, double accounting fees and that kind of thing. So administratively, there's a minor cost as well. Again, to me, I wouldn't say it's material, but that's relative to how much money your business is making at that point in time.
Do you suggest a minimum that your company would make before you would incorporate yourself?
No, because there are other considerations. If I was in a business where the shield for personal liability was hugely important to me, I might say that cost is worth it because I would sooner have that shield for liability or for credibility. Like, I have a lot of technology clients developing like internet products and whatnot, and they just have to be incorporated to talk to anyone. They wouldn't be taken seriously if they didn't. So it's just a cost they have to pay up front.
So even when you first start a business, you could incorporate yourself from day one?
You can, yes. Yes. The other, not really a downside, but to realize that, you know, many banks and landlords and others, the people maybe who you're trying to shield yourself from for liability, they may just ask for personal guarantees. If you're the board of directors, the employee, the officer, the shareholder, they just may say, oh, let's give me a personal guarantee before I'll deal with your company. So it may end up being a little illusionary. A personal guarantee is, say you borrow $10,000 from the bank for your business. Mm-hmm. The bank would say, well, your company has no assets, so I want you personally to sign saying if the company defaults, you personally will pay it. The other slightly illusionary thing about it is the whole concept of limited liability, because there's a lot of statutory a lot of statutes have eroded that. And I'll get to that in one second. Going back to timing on incorporation, you can incorporate before you've done anything, or you can run your business for 2 or 3 years and incorporate later and then just roll your business into the company. It costs a little bit more money to do it that way, because there's a bit of paperwork and a filing with CRA to do. But you can. So if you're starting out and you don't have a big budget, you can run your business as a sole proprietorship for a year or two, and then you say, okay, I've got enough money. This is going to work. I think it's worth incorporating. You hire a lawyer. You incorporate. Pay your $1,200 for that. And then there's probably another fee of about $1,000 or $2,000 to roll your business in. And it's called a roll-in because basically happens is you take your business here and you own it, right? I said it's personal. You own this business. You sell your business to your corporation and then you take back shares in the corporation. You sell it in. So you're selling it to your alter ego and it's called a rollover and the government won't tax that. There's a little bit of paperwork, which is why it costs more. But you're doing it at a time, hopefully, when your business is making money. So, yeah, it's costing you a bit more money to do it that way, but you didn't have to pay for it until you had money to spend. So it's not something you have to do up front is the key message on that. Word about share provisions, which is the next point. You've probably heard of terms such as common shares and preferred shares and special shares and warrants and all this kind of stuff. If you're going to a lawyer for a simple business and you want a company and the lawyer starts talking about those things, tell him or her no. And if they argue with you, then just leave and go and find another lawyer. It's my advice. The reason is all these things, common shares, preferred shares, special shares, they're very complicated, long provisions. And they do all kinds of crazy rights, like the people that own Canadian Tire, I forget the family name, Vasily or something. I can't remember their name. They control it with multiple voting shares. You know, they have like 10 votes for every one share that they hold compared to the common. You know, Magna did this. Stronach at Magna did the same thing. Those are special shares. They do all kinds of crazy things that bankers like and lawyers like and investors like, but you don't need it in a simple business. The lawyer, to do it, will charge you for it. So he'll say, well, you don't need it now, but you might need it down the road. So what he's actually saying is pay for it now on the off chance you might need it 3 years from now. And my advice would always be, well, if I need it 3 years from now, I'll pay for it then and have it done then. I won't do it now. For a simple incorporation, you only need common shares, especially if you're going to be the only owner of the business. If you're going to own it with a family member or partner, common shares work very fine. They basically say you know, one share, one person, one vote. They're, you know, it's very equal. And it works just fine. You don't need all that complicated stuff. So if anyone suggests it to you, say no. Personal liability considerations. Now, because you're a nutritionist, this is where the corporation may not be that good, that great of a thing for you. When the corporation does something, it can be liable, right? I said that. And the shareholders aren't subject to that liability. Remember I said that?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem. The employee, and that's you. You do something and say a client gets sick or doesn't like you and they sue you. That's really what you're concerned with for liability, right? Someone suing you. That's why you have insurance and everything else. They have a choice. They can either sue you, the employee, for negligence or malpractice, which is something called a tort, or they can sue the company for negligence and malpractice because they went to your company for the service. They can pick who they sue. Or they can sue both of you and just let a judge figure it out. So when you're providing a professional practice like I do and like you do, the fact that you as a shareholder cannot be liable for more than your $1,000 doesn't matter when you, the employee, can be liable for an unlimited amount of damages here when someone sues you because you're in every single piece. Or you, the director up here. It's not such a big problem in a business where it's not a professional practice because, you know, most people aren't sued for what they do. But when you're concerned about potential liability and you're dealing in a health industry where that, you know, if something goes wrong, it can really go wrong and cause a problem. That can be, you know, that's where you can have big liability. You have practice insurance, you know, that's one of your big protectors against that, of course. And, you know, often a corporation can be as well, but in this instance, because they always have the option of suing you for negligence personally, it doesn't protect you from malpractice consequences. But what it does protect you against is, you know, the landlord, you know, the landlord money for your clinic, because the landlord wouldn't be able to sue you personally, contractors with the corporation. It would protect you against the bank if you borrowed money. If you've leased a car, it would protect you against that. But personal malpractice, it won't protect you for. The name we give to it in law is called a tort. And tort is essentially the law of duty. And what it means is that each of us walking around this world, we all owe a duty to everyone that we come into contact with. And that duty is to not be negligent and to not harm them, not hit them in the face. Now, some of it's easy to control. But some of it is, you know, you make a mistake and someone afterwards says, man, a reasonable person wouldn't have made that mistake. I'm sorry, you're responsible for that person's illness. And then that's how you get sued. And that's essentially what malpractice is negligence in your professional duty.
So even if you have them sign a form upon, you know, becoming a client,
yeah,
they can still sue you.
Oh, sure, yeah. No, a judge wouldn't care about that. No, judges wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a case. I mean, and there's good reason for it. There's a case where years ago, I remember at law school, it's not dealing with the medical malpractice area, but it's kind of a fun case anyway to learn about. This fellow was driving a dirt bike, and he used to drive in this rock quarry. And so the quarry owner realized the kids were driving dirt bikes there. So the guy put like a 10-foot fence around it, padlocked it, and had warning signs, danger, death hazard, do not enter, all this kind of stuff. And the kids broke the lock, went in, drove the dirt bike down. Unfortunately, one of them fell off a cliff, broke his neck, and became a quadriplegic. So now he's in court suing the quarry owner for negligence for not properly securing the property. You would think it's laughable. Why would that? How could that person win? And the answer is because judges are human beings. And on the one hand, he has an 18-year-old quadriplegic whose life has been ruined. On the other hand, he has a quarry with an insurance company backing. And if he finds what we would say justice is, that 18-year-old has no money and his life is over. But if he finds a way to make that quarry owner responsible, it's coming out of insurance anyway. The quarry owner is going to be okay, the insurance company, you know what I mean? So that's why they tend to make these strange decisions. So yeah, you have signed forms and everything, but if you're a judge, you've got two human beings in front of you and one with malpractice insurance, you know, another one's been wrong. If their heart's in a certain place, they'll find a way to make the decision that they want.
Was he awarded damages?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, just like that person in California stuffed the coffee down their pants and then burned themselves. Or was that a Seinfeld episode?
No, that never happened.
I can't remember. Anyway.
Now, having said that, though, the reality is that it's extremely rare, I think, historically in our profession. For people to have been sued. And from what I understand from Lackner McLennan, who is the insurance company that we work through with CANMP, there's more likelihood of someone being sued because of some issue with their property, like a slip and fall. I don't think they've had a claim as yet for malpractice in the line of, you know, duties and consulting and that kind of thing. And that's why the insurance company with Lackner, the policy, was a little bit more compared to, I think, partners. And she said the reason being is because you are covered for the slip and fall and those kinds
that
of things.
General liability. Right. So you don't have to use your own house insurance, which sometimes says to you, yeah, except if you're running a business in the fine print.
Yeah, and so some people may think they're covered with their house policy if they're operating out of their home, and they're not. So just be aware.
Yeah, but which is a really great point. So if you actually, so going back to my getting incredibly messed up board here, if you actually have insurance, and you should, covering off all but incredibly ridiculous claims, if you're protected here with insurance, then you may look back at the corporation and say, okay, I'm covered with insurance here. This protects me against my landlord, my car. That's worth having. So you may still go for the corporation.
Yeah, because what is the probability that we may be sued for more than our insurance coverage will?
Yeah, not much. Not much. That said, having seen some of the conversation on chat lines, I would say, nutritionists have a habit of dabbling into diagnosing and treating diseases. And if you do that and you make a mistake with a disease that is, you know, serious,
even though
your insurance company says there haven't been many claims, that's the big area I could see it happening. When you're promoting health and wellness, I agree. But if you get into the other area. Just moving along, the other areas of personal liability. I mean, the government's eroded some of them, and what they've done is they've said, since we have this board of directors up here, this brain, if the company commits fraud, we're not going to let we'll let the shareholders off, but we're going to hold the board of directors accountable because those are the ones that made the decision to commit fraud. If they fail to pay us our taxes, they fail to pay the employees, if they don't remit source deductions, all those kinds of things, directors are personally liable. So you as everything, you won't be liable here because you're an employee. You won't be liable here because you're a shareholder. You won't be liable here as an officer, but you will be liable here as a director. So you have lots of hats. Just like in your life, you know, you're a child, a parent, a sister, a brother, a husband, or whatever, all these different things. You're the same within your company, and you wear all those hats at one time. So the decision to incorporate often becomes an amalgam of looking at all of this and saying, okay, what do I really care about, and does this solve my problem? Okay.
All right. Are there ongoing costs to incorporation, legal costs?
No. The question is, are there ongoing legal costs? And the answer is effectively no. Depending on where you incorporate, there can be an annual filing that's done with the registrar, and that would be the federally, and that can be a minor cost of a couple hundred dollars a year. But your only ongoing cost really is the need to prepare a separate set of books and file taxes.
Right. And insurance is more when you're insuring for a corporation rather than as an individual practitioner.
I think so.
Yeah, that I don't know. I want to say a word about employment versus consulting in the business context, because many of you may be working as consultants or employees with organizations. Or clinics, and a lot of people don't understand what the difference is and why the difference can sometimes be very, very important. The concept of an employee comes out of the old British tradition of master and servant. And if you think back to that image of, you know, in a Jane Austen film with the butler running around and them telling the staff what to do, that really is what an employee is. It's a master and a servant, and it's that master saying to the employee everything that they have, you know, telling them what to do. Go here, go there, use this in your job, work these 40 hours, and directing every aspect of their life. A consultant, by contrast, in theory, is supposed to be totally different. A classic consultant is myself. You hire me and say, can you incorporate this company for me? And I say yes. And I do it on my equipment, on my time, my discretion, and all I give you at the end of the day is a completed product. That's a classic consultant. Over the last 20 years, in an effort to get around some of the costs of having employees, because it does cost a little bit more to have employees, and because people love the tax write-offs at home of having a home office, everyone and their grandmother is calling themselves a consultant, but while they're working in a full-time position. And if that's you as the consultant, that may be okay, because you get paid, you pay your taxes. If you're on the clinic or the employer side, however, and CRA looks at that relationship and says, that person is really an employee, I'm sorry, I don't believe you that they're a consultant, you can then suddenly be liable for a couple of years' worth of source deductions, plus hefty penalties and an interest on top of that. And you can have a large tax bill to CRA. And your argument will be, but the employee was supposed to file it, and the CRA will say, I don't care. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. That's for you to figure out with the employee. Meanwhile, cut us a check for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, whatever it is. So it can be a big problem. So the question is, when are you an employee and when are you a consultant? And, they look at a couple of things, and it goes back to that image of that master-servant verse, that I gave you earlier on. They look at who controls the work. They look at who owns the tools that the employee is using. They look at whether or not the employee is having a risk of profit or loss, or if they're just being paid on an hourly rate. And then they look overall, just a smell test. It's called integration. What do they think? Is it really an independent business or not? So if you're a consultant in a clinic, and the clinic tells you when and where to work, or you're a clinic and you're employing someone, oxymoron there, and you tell them when and where to work, and you give them all the equipment, and you give them the forms to use, and you pay them an hourly rate wage, and you give them time off for vacation, if CRA looks at that, that's a revenue agency, they'll say, I don't care if you call it a consultant, that's an employee, and you owe us money. And on the other hand, if the person comes and they work two or three times a week, they also have a business out of their house, so they work for other clinics, and they're like an independent business separate from you, CRA will look at it and say, that's fine. This person does other things as well. They're just here twice a week as a consultant. We buy it. And it's just the point is, don't be too flip about which it is. If you have an employee or you are an employee, fess up and be that. Don't let the Revenue Canada make the decision for you if they ever look at it, because at that point in time, there's penalties and interest and all kinds of complications. Next up. Dealing with intellectual property. So intellectual property is, that's the name given to a whole group of things. It's the name given to area known as, trademarks, and that would be, like the CANNP is a trademark of this association. It's an area given, name given to what's known as copyrights, which is, print, film, media, that kind of stuff. The internet is part of copyright. Yeah, anything on the internet is copyright. It covers the area of patents, which, unless you're involved in product development, developing food products, probably wouldn't touch you. And trade secrets. But there's a few other areas, but these are the big four. And trade secrets are simply. I know you'll hate this example, but it's a recipe as a nutritionist, it's a recipe for Coke, the world's greatest trade secret. What a trade secret is it's simply, we know what it is, but we're not going to tell anybody, so no one will ever be able to copy this, and that's a trade secret. So this is what I want to talk about briefly, because when you're developing a business, it's hugely important, in particular, this one and this one, and in some businesses, but not really yours, again, unless your product development, perhaps trade secrets is hugely important. So the question is, you've got a business, and you want to run this business, and you want to be able to protect your name probably, right? Maybe your logo and your brand, your brand if it's slightly different than your name. And we have a bit of a scale here. And some things you can do, and for most of us, the name of our business is fundamental intellectual property, right? It's your trademark, it's your identity to the public, it's the key thing you want to protect. So we have on one side we have deterrent, and on the other hand we have exclusive. What I mean by this is some things deter other people from breaching our intellectual property, and other things give us exclusive rights to it. And this is obviously the best one to be under. Have you ever heard of a business name registration? Okay. So when you operate a business, if it's under any name other than the legal name of either you personally or your corporation, you have to register what's called a business name. Okay? A business name is only a deterrent. What a business name registration is that's basically a registry. And what that's doing is you're just saying to the government, using myself as an example, I, Glenn Rumble, am going to carry on business under the name Ross Rumble, for whatever reason. Actually, because my partner's last name is Ross. And I'm going to register that with you. So if anyone ever wonders who the heck this Ross Rumble is, they can go to the government and they'll get a name, address, phone number, and they'll be able to contact. Particularly important with products, say, you know, this one is My Vitality product. The company may be 1234 Ontario Limited. Who knows? It might just be a numbered company, but they come under My Vitality. If you drink this and it makes you sick, and you're looking on it, say, how do I contact these people? Because they're in business in the province of Ontario, I don't want to say the product would make you sick. It's a hypothetical. But you could look them up in the registry, and it will give you the name, address, and contact information for the principals of the company. So you can contact them, sue them, do whatever. If they stiff the government for money, the government finds out about them the same way. That's all a business name is. And because there's a registry of it, when someone wants to go into business, they'll go to a lawyer, and the lawyer will search the business registry, and I'll say, I've got a great name for a company, My Vitality. And the lawyer will look it up and say, oh, no, sorry, there is a company out there already like that. I don't recommend using it. I could, but I don't recommend it. So that's why business names are deterrents.
So under your Ontario number company,
mm-hmm.
how many names can you have?
Unlimited.
And you just keep adding them?
Yep. Yeah. So many large corporations have branding divisions, and they have all different brands and whatnot. Yeah.
And the second question is, since I did everything online, like the business name registration, was it looked up? Or did they just accept my word for it?
They just accept your word for it. It's a registry. There's a fine, and you know, if you lie to them, but no, there's no one policing it really.
Okay, but someone else can have the same name.
Yes, yes. The business registry is simply that. It's just a registry. It's a register of names, nothing more.
Okay, so who looks it up then to see if you can have it exclusively to a lawyer?
No, that's a different. We'll get to that. Oh, yeah. Okay. So the same thing hits many different pegs. So you have your name. First thing it's a business name. You register it if it's not your legal name. If it's your legal name, you can skip that step. Okay? The next thing you can have is your web address. Silly thing to have up here in a sense because it's not a legal right, but the reality in the modern world is if you have the URL for something, My Vitality, chances of someone else setting up their own product called MyVitality. Is almost non-existent. Everyone wants their product.com or .ca. So if you're setting up your business and you want to create a real barrier to someone else copying your name because you think it's just dead on the money, just register. It's cheap to do, you know, .com, .net, .ca, .this, .that, you know, whatever it is. You get all the URLs. Just buy them up. And a lot of businesses, actually, they buy up all the negative URLs as well. I don't know if you appreciate that or not. Particularly politicians like to do that. Yeah, Obama sucks. Obama, you know, it's all Republicans tried to get it, and the Democrats bought it up, and, you know, so all the negatives are also purchased.
Obama sucks.
Okay, so somewhere in the middle is actually your corporate name or your legal name. The reason that's in the middle is what the law in Ontario says, actually, take out legal name, because you'll confuse that with your personal name. The law of Ontario says, in all provinces of Canada, two corporations cannot have an identical name. But that's literally identical. So, keeping with my Vitality example, if their company was called My Vitality Health Products Incorporated, I could not have that name in Ontario. But I could have My Vitality Nutrition Products, because it's not identical. And the Ontario government does not police it. It's not identical, they'll let you have it.
Is that the same throughout? You're saying Ontario, but is it?
It depends on the jurisdiction. The federal government will police it. I've had them reject names as being too general or too close.
Okay.
Ontario won't, so that's province by province. But the general rule is identical. For them to deny it, you have to really be getting close. And that's a corporate name.
What is a corporate name?
Oh, When you incorporate a company, you can either take a number that the government gives you, like your phone number, 282-3201 Ontario Inc., or you can choose a name for it, and if it's available, they'll let you have it. So mine's called Ross Rumble Professional Corporation, my partner's last name, my last name, and then Professional Corporation.
This is only for incorporation?
Yes, yes. And, you know, for the CANNP, you know, it's a nonprofit corporation, but that's still a form of corporation. That's its legal name. No one else can have that exact name, but someone, you know, could have a very close name under corporate law. But having the, but once you have a business name, a web address, and a corporate name, you're starting to get a pretty heavy-duty protection, and people will steer away from you.
Isn't there something going on with a restaurant right now about that?
I don't
something
know.
About wings?
Oh, Wild Wings?
Company,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
An American company called Buffalo Wild Wings.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the same thing, but that would be federal? Is that why they're fighting it? Because it's not identical?
No, they are fighting probably because of the next category, which is trademark.
Jumping the gun.
And we have non-registered trademark on one side, which is a deterrent, and then we have a registered trademark on the other side. Okay. So, as we work our way down our names, a trademark is a unique identifier of a business, a source of products or services. So, again, for the Canadian Association of Natural Nutritional Practitioners, CANNP is their trademark. For International Business Machines Incorporated or whatever it is, IBM is a trademark. McDonald Corporation, McDonald's, Golden Arches, that's their trademark. It's a unique identifier with a product or service. You can have two kinds of trademarks. It can be unregistered or non-registered or registered. The great thing about a trademark is it doesn't cost you anything to have one. You get it the moment you use a name. So the moment I'm giving these guys a great plug if this is on podcast. The minute the My Vitality people chose to use My Vitality and they depicted it, you know, in that way, they created a trademark for it, regardless of whether or not it's registered. So the minute you associate yourself with a unique name, you are using a trademark. Yes?
This is all if you are incorporated.
No. The only one that dealt with corporation, it was only the corporate name. I was only making the point that the name of a corporation is a small degree of protection because you can't have another corporation with an identical name. Do you have a business right now? What is it?
Eat Green and Clean.
Eat Green and Clean. That's your trademark. Okay, if that's the name of your business, is it incorporated?
No.
Okay, so if you have that on a business card?
Yes.
Okay, that's the name of your, that's your trademark. It's assuming you haven't registered it, it's an unregistered trademark.
It's registered as a business name.
Right.
But not a
trademark.
Where are you registered as a trademark?
Ottawa, Trademarks Office.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'll speak, actually you can, but I'll just finish explaining the difference. So you'll see an unregistered trademark, we have a right. You know, rights go to the first to use in relation to a product or service. So My Vitality, when they set this on a package or a business card, or you created a business card, you have that trademark. If someone was using it first in association with a similar product in an area, similar geographic area, they would have prior rights to you. So first in time to use it always wins out. But It has to hit all those conditions, because what the courts look to is whether or not a member of the public will be confused. So if there's My Vitality in Ontario and they have no business whatsoever in British Columbia, and some guy wants to set up My Vitality machine shop in British Columbia, they're not going to be able to say they breached the trademark, because who would possibly mistake an auto mechanic in BC for a health food product in Ontario? You wouldn't. So they go to confusion for the public. But as between equals, first to use it in time always wins.
Couple of questions.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily have to pay for the trademark TM.
Nope.
To put TM
nope.
at the end of your business name. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Number two, I have a business name. I came up with it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to one day, you know, I have my website. I have my business name is registered. It's not incorporated yet. And I came across a business out in BC, speaking of BC, that is like a course. It's the name of a course. My business name
has
the name of a course. And I'm like, oh, I hope I'm not doing something wrong.
Yeah.
So if I put TM at the end of my name, I don't know how long they've had this name their business course. Is that going to cause a conflict?
No. Well, this is how that something. So the question is.
It's actually nutrition.
Yeah. So
I'm a nutritionist.
So there's someone in another province that has a virtually identical or identical business name, trademark as you. How is that resolved?
Yeah. Okay. When you have a trademark, we'll go with the CANNP. If you want to, you put the TM after it, if you wish. You don't have to, but if you do, you're declaring to the world, that's my stake in the sand. This is my trademark. Don't monkey with it. That's what you're telling the world. Someone else in another place, actually the CANNP had this problem. should I tread down this path?
Sure, go ahead.
The nurses, right?
No,
CAHNP. They purported to set up business under CAHNP. So very similar to your scenario. So how does it unfold? Beth and Wendy give me a call, and panicked call, and they say that, you know, there's this problem, and so I write a letter to these guys, and I say cease and desist. We had the name first. I don't even know if we did. I'm their lawyer. I make the first assertion. We have it first. You're harming our goodwill. You're harming our business reputation. If you don't stop now, we're going to sue you in court and take your grandmother and children and, you know, all these kinds of things that lawyers like. But you send that kind of a letter, and then the person gets it. And then they Google you, and they say, oh, my goodness, there's someone else out there. And then basically you figure it out between the two of you, because there is no trademark cop out there policing the world. It's you guys figure it out. And usually whoever is right, you know, eventually you'll prove who did it. And whoever's right, whoever had it first, the other side will acquiesce, because no one wants to fight over these things. It costs too much money to pay people like me to be firing these lawyers letters back and forth. So it's really just figure it out with the other people. So if you're using it and they haven't objected,
right. Anything, but I didn't exactly put TM.
But you're not going to make anything worse by putting TM after it. It's the use of the name that already says I'm using it as a trademark. If they get wind of you and it bothers them, then they will send a letter to you saying we think we had rights to it first. And then, you know, you'll do what these guys did, which is make a panic run to your lawyer and say, what do I do? And he will send a letter back saying, you know, screw off, you sure don't. And somewhere in between, people will agree on the middle. But they can be very expensive to fight. And as I say, there is no trademark cop. The only place to resolve it is in court. So usually the side that has less money in their pockets acquiesces. So my advice to clients is always, always, when you're searching out a business name, be really, really sure it doesn't breach another party's trademark, especially someone with deep pockets.
So if... what's the point of paying for a trademark if you can just put TM at the end of your name?
A registered trademark, because of my line here. This is a deterrent. This rules. So a registered trademark is the most powerful protection you can have for your trademark in Canada, because this is the one instance in which the government does become involved, does vet things, and does somewhat certify them. Basically what the government does... You file an application for a trademark with the trademark office. You can do it online yourself, or you can hire a trademark agent. Lawyers actually can't do it unless they're trademark agents. Lawyers can do anything. I think I could even try a murder trial, even though I've been a business lawyer for 30 years, but I can't walk into the trademark office. It's really funny. But the point about it is you file with the government. They then have a trademark officer investigate it, and they look at all the search engines and Googles and Nuances and all these different search engines, and they decide whether or not they think it's confusing. If they think it's confusing or similar, they will fire a letter back saying, no, we won't give it to you, or we have these problems, please address them. And then you respond. They then publish it, and they say, if anyone has any problem with this trademark, let us know. And if it clears that, they will give you the exclusive right to the trademark in Canada in connection with your products and similar products and services. So if in your instance, it would be, you know, in the nutrition area, you'd have exclusive rights to it.
It doesn't mean it can't be challenged. If you're using it for 5 years, 10 years, whatever, down the road someone says, oh, I never saw any of those ads. You know, you didn't have it first. She lied to you, trademark office, that she had it first. Your research was faulty. They can always have an application to what's called expunge it. But it's a lengthy, lengthy process. Almost everybody in the world will bail when they see you have a registered trademark. Every lawyer will tell them, unless you want to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, don't bother fighting it.
How much is it for a trademark?
It costs, if you're going to hire a trademark agent, it would likely be around $1,500 to file the application. And then any additional fees would depend upon whether the trademark office had problems with it and got back to you with problems and whatnot.
If you have an umbrella name,
mm-hmm.
okay, an umbrella name, and let's say your business name is under that umbrella name, and you're incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you're incorporated, you have an umbrella name, and your business name is in that incorporation. Can somebody still take your business name even though you're incorporated?
Well, this is where we get into layers of protection. The simple answer in Canada is anyone can try to do whatever they want.
Okay.
And it's up to you. No, seriously, like clients often ask me, can so-and-so sue me? I say, yeah, anyone can sue anyone. I could sue anyone I want tomorrow. Whether or not I win is a whole different question.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say no one will try to.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have the business name registered, and you have the URL for it, and you have it used in your corporate name, and you have either an unregistered or a registered trademark, either one of those, anyone would be a fool to take you on. Because you've got layer upon layer of things that are saying to them, just don't even bother, life is too short. Because even if they win here, how are they going to get the web address, and they don't have the .coms, and they get, it's a pain. So people will shy away, and any lawyer worth his or her salt will tell them, don't have this battle. So that's, again, my advice is, before you have a business name, search it, Google it, you know, Canada 411 it. There's lots of searches you can do cheaply on your own. Satisfy yourself that there's no other product or service in a similar industry geographically competitive with you. And if there are none of those two things, then go for it. If there is, you've got a tough decision to make if you really like the name, you know. The really bad ones, it always seems to be North Bay for some reason. Every client I have, you end up with this small business in North Bay, and they're looking at it going, but North Bay, what do I do with it? You know, and well, it's in Ontario. It could be a problem. Yeah, I have to tell them. If it was BC or Newfoundland or Alberta, maybe not so much. The other thing about trademarks, by the way, is they are national, meaning Canadian trademark doesn't help in the U.S. A U.S. trademark does not help you in Canada. You have to qualify, or Europe or anywhere else. Any country in which you use them, if you're into product development, every country would have to be qualified on its own. Okay? And any questions about sort of name protection and whatnot? All right. So just to finish off on registered trademarks, because I did it briefly. So as I said, they're vetted. They give you exclusive national rights in connection with your industry or your industry area. So what it does is it removes that geographic component that I mentioned earlier. So if you do have the registered trademark of My Vitality in you're only using it in Ontario, having a registered trademark will protect you from My Vitality nutritional product being a competitor in BC, even though you're not even carrying on business there yet. If you're using an unregistered trademark, you'll only have that protection where you carry on business. They last about 15 years, and then they can be renewed. And as I said, if there's a mistake in the vetting process and someone can prove that, they can be what's called expunged. But that's that doesn't happen a lot because it takes a lot of money. Give you one idea of scale on trademark fights. I have a client that was called Active Plant, and they had a technology software for mining data coming off the robotics in a manufacturing plant. And they rebranded from a horrible name before, Executive Manufacturing Technologies, to Active Plant, which they thought was nice and punchy. And they went to go into the States, and there was an Active Plant in the States, a large agribusiness company. And they were using plant in the context of, you know, plants. And they made seeds and all these kinds of genetically modified things that, you know, that we all hate in this room.
And my client thought, who cares? You're in a totally different industry. No one will confuse them with us. We still think it's a good name. We're using it in Canada. We'll go into the States with it. And they got a letter from the, you know, the other active plant lawyer saying cease and desist. And they, ha, 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 we won't. And they were nailed with the lawsuit. And they finally bailed when they were $250,000 US into the fight. And they rebranded. And they fought and fought and fought. And then they just, you know what, this, and the, even though, and the moral is, you may win when you get to the Supreme Court, you know, but it costs a ton of money to get there. And it's much easier just to create something, you know, right the first time around. Patents were on my list, and you'll see them here. Since no one here is developing new foods, and I don't know that much about patents, we'll skip over that, other than to say a patent is an invention. And if you think you have an invention that's patentable, you would have to file your patent within 1 year of releasing it to the public. And to do a patent, you do have to use patent lawyers. I wouldn't do those. I could, I think, but I wouldn't. And they're very expensive patents. Cheap patents would be $20,000, $25,000. Yeah. Expensive patents would be in the millions. So, but it is a specialty. It's not something you can do yourself. No. You could legally, but you wouldn't want to. Yes. Okay. Copyright is another area of intellectual property. Again, I don't think you would deal with that too much in your area, other than, say, Beth and Wendy, you had the paper trail. So that would be a copyrightable product in the nutrition industry, which is, you know, copyright exists in anything that's put down in print, image, film, you know, sound recordings. Like a trademark, it exists the moment you do it. So I have the copyright in this in front of you. By giving it to you, I'm giving you an implied license to use it for the purposes of this seminar. I haven't put any restrictions on it, you know, but if I were to see this out there in identical form with your name on it, I could charge you with plagiarism and get an order stopping you from doing that. So copyright exists from the moment it's put down in paper.
Do you have to pay to have something?
No, it's like a trademark. It exists just by the fact that you put your ideas in paper. But what it protects is the expression of the idea, not the idea itself. So if you think of, you know, the Harry Potter books, that's why J.K. Rowling's, she has the copyright in the Harry Potter series, but there's hundreds of imitations of little boy wizards running around now with dragons and, you know, and sorcerers and things, right? Because it's such a popular media. She doesn't own the idea. Anyone can create their own version of it as long as it's their own creation.
So if we write, which I've done before, mm-hmm. I think I sort of regretted it after. I'm thinking, oh, geez, I wish I had it copyrighted and paid for kind of thing. So if I write, like, a whole new menu plan and it's unique in itself in the way that I just put it together and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
added different things and stuff, and it's my own idea,
mm-hmm.
and let's say a company asks for my help in creating something like that, and I give them that,
mm-hmm.
essentially, can they take that, whatever I've written, and say that it is their own,
well,
without me putting the C behind it? Like, you know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what you've done, I mean, it depends on when you say you give it to them. If you can transfer copyright, you would still be credited as the author, but someone else would own the right. Copyright means what it says, the right, you know, the right over copies.
Mm-hmm.
So they would own the right to commercialize it and sell it if you sold it to them. But they would have to, they couldn't claim authorship of it. I mean, that's something else. But what you've copyrighted is the expression of your idea, not the idea itself. Think of it as, what is it, Alcoholics Anonymous have 10 steps or 12 steps or something. That has been riffed in every... that has been riffed in every which way possible by 1,000 organizations around the world, right? Because it's a neat little model. So they don't own 12 steps. They own their exact articulation of the 12 steps. But the notion of dividing a redemptive, curing a disease, an addictive disease or a redemptive process into 12, you know, steps, that's used by everybody. So you can't control that. Once the idea is out of the box, you're not going to control the idea. The C is claiming copyright. I have it there. On the bottom of page 7, you'll see an example of a copyright notice for an unregistered copyright. C, Ross Rumble Professional Corporation, and the year. That's a copyright notice. When you see the R, that's claiming a registered copyright notice.
Oh.
And there's very little benefit to, there's very little benefit to registering a copyright notice. I wouldn't even bother going into it.
So I could do exactly like you and just...
Yes, absolutely.
But as long as I put the year down.
That's part of the notice. Okay. It's, again, it's not necessary. Mm-hmm. It's putting your stake in the sand and telling the world this is copyrighted. One of the problems with the internet is, you know, you don't have copyright notices everywhere, and everyone thinks it's free information. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's just a different medium. And all of that, everything you see on the internet is copyright protected. And whoever put it there has ownership of that copyright. And you only can use it in accordance with their permission.
It's all that fine print stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The final area is confidential information and trade secrets. And again, won't involve you very much unless you were manufacturing a natural health product. But you may touch upon it because you may be asked to sign a non-confident or a confidentiality agreement or a non-disclosure agreement by some crazy paranoid clinic somewhere, or someone else you're doing business with. You know, in the technology area that I work in, all my clients use them because in technology, that's the main way of protecting what you have. But basically, it's all it's saying to the world is, I have a secret. I'll tell you, but if I tell you, you can't tell anyone else. And that's what this agreement says. You won't tell anybody. You'll only use it for the purpose in which I'm giving it to you. You know, so if you have a health product and you want someone else to manufacture it, you would give them the recipe and you would have them sign a non-disclosure agreement that they can't use it for any other purpose other than to make your food for you. Blah, blah. Okay, and that brings us to part two, issues specific to a nutritionist practice. These are just some things that occurred to me in looking at some of the questions that I've seen floating around in various chat rooms, some of the things that have been asked of us or that I've commented on in various voices. So hopefully some of it will be of interest to everybody, even if maybe you also know parts of it. The first thing I want to touch upon is if you're running a practice in Ontario or any province, actually, is scope of practice. And I know this is mentioned when you're taking your programs, but I thought it would be beneficial if you haven't. I've seen some of the teaching materials some of the schools have, and it doesn't go into a lot of detail or explanation about this stuff, which is why I wanted to mention it now. Is in Ontario, using Ontario as our model here for a moment, there's something called the Regulated Health Professions Act of Ontario. And what it does is it says, here's a list of all the things that we think are so risky that only specially qualified people can do them. And then in various statutes, we'll say which people get to do them. And the Regulated Health Professions Act contains that list. Some provinces have a different model, like Saskatchewan or New Brunswick, most of the Maritimes actually, and they say you cannot practice medicine, or you cannot practice psychiatry, or you cannot practice dietetics, or something like that. But other provinces have a more modern legislation, Alberta, Ontario, Manitoba is moving towards it. I think BC as well. And they basically regulate the act. So what are the acts that they regulate? And these are the thou shalt nots of the health profession area. And I've set them out on page 9. And some of them are, you know, you would never do, I hope, as a nutritionist, such as setting or casting a fracture of a bone or a dislocation of a joint. Hopefully that does not come up in your day-to-day business. But a couple of them would. The first one. Communicating to the individual or his or her personal representative a diagnosis identifying a disease or a disorder or the cause of symptoms of the individual in circumstances in which it is reasonably foreseeable that the individual or his personal representative will rely on that diagnosis, i.e. diagnosing diseases. That's something that is said you have to be an approved health profession, and I'll get to what those are in a second, to do that. And it's not an unregistered nutritionist. And I say unregistered meaning some provinces have nutrition as a category that they have registered. In Ontario, if you are a nutritionist, meaning you're not a dietitian practicing in this area, you know, you cannot do that. And that it's in the statute. The second one, you probably wouldn't do, but there's actually one case where someone did this. Performing a procedure on tissue below the dermis, below the surface of the mucous membrane, inner below the surface of the cornea, or inner below the surface of the teeth, including the scaling of teeth. So you can't stick needles into people. So you can't be an amateur acupuncturist, for example, or give them shots of B12 or things like that, obviously. A few more down, I think it's the fifth one, administering a substance by injection or inhalation. So that catches it there as well. On the next page, This one is interesting. Third bullet on page 10, prescribing, dispensing, selling, or compounding a drug as defined in the Drug and Pharmacies Regulation Act, or supervising the part of a pharmacy where such drugs are kept. Sounds like that may be a problem for you. It's not, because happily the Drug Pharmacies and Regulations Act excludes natural health products. So by recommending natural health products to someone, you are not prescribing, dispensing, or selling or compounding a drug as defined in that legislation. So to do that, to breach this, you'd have to be prescribing prescription drugs. And then the final one at the very end, again, second last one, hopefully you're not managing labor or conducting the delivery of a baby.
Not on purpose.
Not on purpose. But the last one being, you know, allergy challenge testing of a kind in which a positive result of the test is a significant allergic response. I know many holistic practitioners have muscle testing that they do. That's not what they're talking about, because they're saying the response is a significant allergenic response. So I think that's someone has a dust allergy, so you know when they prick the skin and they put a bit of the allergen in you to see if there's a skin reaction. That's what they're really talking about there. But that is it. This list is all that is restricted in the province of Ontario. The biggie being the first one, of course, you know, the diagnosis of diseases. So then what they do is they have separate statutes for very different professions. So medical doctors are allowed to do all of this. Nurses are allowed to do a couple of categories. Naturopaths haven't been, their college has been, it's being constituted, it's not fully active yet. Once they're fully proclaimed, their statute's proclaimed, they will be able to do some of those activities and not others. So that's how the government then decides in Ontario, in BC and Alberta, who have similar legislation, that's how they regulate the health professions, by activity. So as unregistered outside the regulated health professions, you can do none of these.
Glenn, I have a question about pharmacists.
Yes.
They have this thing where you can go in and you can talk to them about the drugs that you're taking. Can we talk to our clients about drug interactions, or is that stepping on their toes?
I think drugs would be, it sounds like to me that would be, that's a good question. Let's look at the list.
But like, I know a lot of the clients that I'm dealing with, they're older clients, so they're on a lot of medication, so I need to know what herbs that they can take
that's
going to interact with the drugs.
You know,
I
what?
Think they can do that. Can we not? Like, well, if
in a consultation.
Right, yeah. We have a responsibility there with that. And I was going to say that with for CNAP members, there's Natural Standards database, and you can actually plug in there medications that your client is on and herbs and things that you may want to recommend, and it will pop up and tell you contraindications.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to know.
I think it would be one thing to be opining on their meds, and another thing to say, what meds are you on, so I can recommend supplements that won't conflict with them.
Exactly.
I think this, you know, that is fine. But I wouldn't be opining on their meds, because then you're getting into, you're becoming involved in the treatment of their diseases, because the meds are required, presumably prescribed to treat a disease.
Can you give them like a list of if they give you a list of the meds they're taking, can you give them a list that the meds are interacting with certain things? Can you give that to them?
That's the opposite.
Yeah.
The
meds.
I don't think you can do that.
I think in that situation, if I suspected something, I would ask them to speak to their doctor and perhaps provide information they should provide to their doctor and say that you believe there could be some complications. But I would not want to be second-guessing any prescription from a doctor or interfering with that. There's I'm actually writing a book right now on health regulation in Canada, and there's a case that I found that's really interesting, and it was some people out in Alberta, and they were called phytologists. I'd never heard that name before. But it's somewhat like nutrition in that they believed in treating the body holistically and reinforcing the immune system and, you know, nutritional supplements and all that kind of stuff. But they also added – they also had in a very significant spiritual component that some nutritionists have, some don't. I mean, it's not strictly part of your training and other kinds of things. Make a long story short, a fellow came to them with terminal lung cancer. And the according to the court case, they told him, we can cure it. Do not do no chemotherapy, no radiation, please. And they gave him B12 shots and hydrogen peroxide. And, of course, the person died. And so that's an extreme example, though, of them interfering with, you know, the, and so they were charged under a different statute than this, but because that was a province which had, you know, you, thou shalt not practice medicine. And the question was, in, you know, in prescribing the nutritional supplements and the B12 shots and the hydrogen peroxide, which the person drank and applied to his skin, you know, were they practicing medicine? And the answer came back, yes, because they were prescribing a treatment for a disease. But the judge was equally bothered by the fact that they interfered and they recommended against the radiation and chemotherapy. And that's why I would be very hesitant to, okay?
I'm just trying to figure out a way how to word it properly.
Well, the best thing, I mean, when you're unregistered, the best thing you can do is actually be in partnership with a registered profession. So, it would be to work in conjunction with a physician or a naturopath or a homeopath or a Chinese medical practitioner, one of those professions. And so in your case, I think giving them some information to provide to their doctor or perhaps asking if you could speak to the doctor or may join them in an appointment or something might be a good way to proceed. Okay? Next area is titles. And I think you all know this. Hopefully you do. But there's certain things that you cannot call yourselves in certain provinces. In Ontario, you cannot use the word doctor. You cannot call yourself a dietitian. You cannot call yourself a naturopath soon. And you cannot call yourself a Chinese medical practitioner or an acupuncturist soon. I say soon because those acts have been passed but not yet proclaimed into force because they're still getting their colleges organized. But otherwise, you can call yourself anything. In other provinces, Alberta and Nova Scotia, nutritionist is also reserved for use by dietitians, so you cannot use the word nutritionist.
Some can't use anything.
Yeah. And other provinces have expanded lists. There's certainly an encroachment happening that years ago the government only worried about regulating the big professions, psychiatry, medicine, dentistry, that kind of stuff. And then with the, you know, over the last 30 years, with so many alternative medicines coming up, they're registering, you know, more professions. But because they do that, they're starting to have a more exclusive perspective and thinking, we've registered colleges and people should be within the college if they're going to provide a service. So there's a certain pressure happening now, I think, on the nutrition community that you know, dietitians are expanding their scope a little bit and the provinces are showing a little bit of a bias towards the dietitians at the expense of what you can easily do, hence the name restrictions. But in Ontario, you can practice the profession of a dietitian. You can do exactly what a dietitian does. There's no restriction on the activity because it wasn't in our list. But what there is a restriction on the name. Client records. There is a statute in Ontario and many other provinces. In Ontario, it's called the Personal Health Information Act. And this regulates access, storage, and collection, access, and storage to personal information, personal health information. And a healthcare practitioner for the purposes of this statute is anyone that provides healthcare. And healthcare means, essentially, I have it there, any service done for a health-related purpose and is carried out or provided to prevent disease or injury or to promote health. So certainly in what you do in promoting health and preventing disease within this act, you would be a healthcare practitioner. Nice how they fit you in there when they want to constrain you, but not when they want to help you. The major, it's not too onerous, though. I mean, it's almost common sense. I just want you to be aware of the statutes out there. It basically says that you only can collect personal health information with the person's consent. So hopefully you're using intake forms. You should have on there some kind of I consent to. And you have to tell them what you're using it for. You know, I consent to the collection and use of this information for the evaluation of my nutritional health, something of that nature. Once you have it, you have to take reasonable efforts to keep it secure. You know, you can't keep it in an open filing box on your back porch. It should be, you know, within your house under lock and key, you know, behind a closed door in your house or on your computer, you know, that kind of thing. If you're going to use off-site storage, there are some rules for off-site storage. pardon me, that you should look at. And by if your client wants to see the information, you have to disclose it to them. If the client ends up having someone appointed for them, or they pass away and their estate wants to see it, there is rules about releasing the information to someone other than your client. So it just governs generally the collection and use of that information. Municipal licensing. This is a really interesting one, and this is one that caught me by surprise, actually. And as far as I'm aware, now I haven't done an exhaustive survey, the City of Toronto, it seems to be the only one that's doing this right now, but that's not carved in stone, because I tried to find it for Vancouver, Montreal, what's the city north of Toronto? Vaughan?
Vaughan.
City above Toronto?
Vaughan.
Yeah. I tried, because I heard rumors that Vaughan was going to implement it, but I couldn't actually find that they had. So I think Toronto's the only one, but I wouldn't swear by it. If you're in a city other than Toronto, you should look into what I'm about to say. Municipalities have the power to regulate the use of land, right? That's what zoning is, and they zone commercial and residential. And they have the right to require licenses for certain business activities to take place on land. So the City of Toronto, in an effort to combat body rub parlors, decided that any holistic center is a potential front for prostitution. So they require...
Go figure.
They require any holistic center, which is defined to be a place at which holistic services are provided. And holistic services, any modality used as a tool for therapeutic and wellness, so basically anything, in the health industry, requires a municipal license to carry on business. To get a municipal license, you have to pay, I think it's $150 or so. It's not too high of a fee. But it comes with a site inspection. They want to inspect the premises to make sure they're suitable for your holistic center. So far, so good. If you're in a commercially zoned area or retail zoned area, that will go without a hitch if you're a legitimate business. If you want to operate out of your house, they will not let you. And the reason is, to operate a holistic practice in a residential area, you have to be a member of a regulated health profession. So we go back up to that provincial legislation that has doctors and dentists and naturopaths and etc. The only time the City of Toronto will allow you to have a holistic center in a residential premises is if you are a registered health profession. So that's the bad news. And I have a friend that's an acupuncturist, and he dealt with the City of Toronto on this because he had to move out of his storefront for a period of time and set up in the basement of his house. Nice, quiet little practice, no outside signage, but a neighbor complained. And that's, the good news. Zoning is enforced on, it's complaint-based enforcement. So if you're carrying on the business out of your home and no one ever complains, the City of Toronto is not going to find out, and on the QT I've been told they're really not going to care. It's there, so if neighbors complain, if parking on the street is taken up with your clients, you stick a sign out front that people find unsightly, or you just have a nosy neighbor that doesn't like what you're doing, and they complain to the city, the city has something it can do about it. And what it will do about it is it will tell you to give you a period of time to transition your business to a proper location. And they will come back again and again and hassle you until you do. Yes?
For the title of holistic practitioner, I remember years ago, going way back when the City of Toronto first came out with this,
mm-hmm.
and how they wanted all the alternative holistic practitioners
mm-hmm.
regardless of whatever the modality was, mm-hmm. to go and register themselves with City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was $150. I actually started off with $40 a day, mm-hmm. whatever. Do you know if that is still around now? Because I haven't done that in years. And is there a basis for even registering yourself with the City of Toronto as a holistic practitioner if you're a nutritionist or aromatherapist?
Yeah, certainly if you're carrying on your own business, by virtue of the fact that your holistic practitioner, your place of business becomes a holistic center, and therefore it has to register. And I don't know if I brought the City of Toronto regs with. I did not. So I don't know if the individual practitioner has to register or not. The center does. I don't know if the individual does or not. So whatever municipality you're in, it's worth checking zoning and bylaw And I'd also say if you're in a condo corp and you're relying on that for your business, anywhere there can be restrictions on what you do, it's actually worth the inquiry. All these are complaint-based, but it can be a real pain if your whole profit center is based on, you know, using your home facility and suddenly you have to rent a place. It can be pretty awful. The final topic I wanted to comment on briefly, because, again, I saw it was very topical in the emails, particularly over Christmas, was Bill C-36. And what I curb on was the near panic that people had when it was going through. Mm-hmm. And for people that don't know, Bill C-36, it was a continuation of a sequence of bills, basically consumer protection legislation of the federal government. And in those various iterations, it did change. And it was at one time threatening natural health products and your industry. But they actually made changes to it. And I'll tell you first the good news is it states explicitly at Section 4.3, this act does not apply to natural health products as defined in the natural health product regulations. So all the concern would be Bill C-36 that it was going to, and I'll tell you what it does now, override and make miserable, you know, your lives and your dealings with natural health products. It's all misplaced fear. It cannot do that. It cannot touch it. It cannot be changed by regulation. It's in the statute itself. It's carved in stone until Parliament changes it, makes it otherwise. So what does this act do? This act is to protect, I put it right there, the purpose, quote of the act, to protect the public by addressing and preventing dangers to human health or safety that are posed by consumer products in Canada, including those that circulate within Canada and those that are imported. This is the act under which lawn darts, you know, are prohibited. You know, it's a continuation of an old act. I remember when I was kids, they had this great game. I don't know if you ever had it. You had the big rings on the ground. And they had 2-foot-long darts with metal tips, and you threw them at your buddy. It was an insane sport.
Your
kids? Yeah.
It's just going to be fun.
Yeah. It's a great sport, but, I mean, when you think about 5-year-olds looking as a dart comes. Anyway, this is the act that's meant to prevent things like that. Now, it's expanded. I'm being facetious. It's expanded greatly since then, and it also does ban certain food products, you know, that are toxic. But that's primarily the function of the Food and Drugs Act, not this act. This act is really consumer protection. So this act prohibits the manufacturing, sale, and importation and advertisements of products that are listed in Schedule 2, which is all of 10 products long, of which one is lawn darts. It makes mandatory for manufacturers, importers that are selling consumer products to report dangerous incidents. So if you have a product and people are harmed, you have to tell the government about it. It empowers the government to without warrant, and this is one of the big controversial things, without warrant and court supervision, go into a place that they think harmful consumer products are and seize the things, get them off the market first, and then figure out later whether or not there's a problem. Because their fear is if they have to go to court, our distribution systems in the modern era are so fast and so pervasive, it just seeds, you know, it seeds out there, and then they can't call it back. So they have all these powers to get in there and grab this stuff. So why was all the controversy about it, and what is the controversy? And what is that group that we support as an association that was very big in all of this?
The Buckleys?
The Buckley Group,
N-A-P-C. Yeah, but they,
N-A-H-P-P-A.
If you go to their website, they say that the act changed and it no longer threatens natural health products. So it regulates harmful consumer products, but a natural health product that's harmful cannot be regulated under this act. So those products are not subject to the seizure without warrants and all the things that people were complaining about. But the reason why some people in the natural health community are still concerned about it is that the powers are very broad. They were given to Health Canada, and Health Canada does enforce, you know, natural health products under the National Health Product Regulation. And they're afraid that this is the leading edge, that now that they have these powers in this area, they're going to ask Parliament for the powers in that area. So it doesn't mean that it's not, and you know, also legitimately they're concerned about our rights as free individuals, the fact that the government can come in without a search warrant into your place of business and seize products and hold them and perhaps even destroy them, and you have no recourse to the courts. So there's human rights concerns as well, but that's slightly different than being concerned with natural health products. What you should be concerned about with natural health products, and what really is going on now, is that the natural health product regulations which were enacted back in, I think, 2004, 2005, and were being phased in over 6 years, are now fully implemented as of February 2011. And what that means is that for a health product to be sold in a store by a retailer anywhere in Canada, that it has to either have a license or it has to be subject to a Health Canada exemption order. And if the product does not have an exemption order or a license, it cannot be sold. And if you're a retailer and you're trying to sell it, they will come in and they will take it off your shelf. And
does it say right on the bottle? Does it say right
yeah,
on the
like supplement? Like this one here, if I had my glasses, I saw something mentioned here. It says natural health product, something approved.
NPN applied for.
Okay, applied for. So that would be their license applied for. So this is subject to an exemption order. What an exemption order is, so obviously when these regs came in 2004, 2005, there were tens of thousands of health products out there. And they've had a daunting task in trying to regulate them. And many people think they shouldn't. Health products should not be regulated like they're drugs. And that's a legitimate philosophical perspective. But that's a debate for a different seminar than this one. They had so many to license. They thought, okay, to license a product, we have to investigate and prove that it's healthy and safe and all these different things. That's an onerous task. So what we'll do is we'll have a fast track procedure, and we'll do a quick look. And if it contains ingredients that we know are safe, we'll give it an exemption order until we get around to really giving it a thorough investigation and a full application. So that's where the exemption orders came in. And for the last 6 years, they allowed exemption-ordered licensed products and unlicensed products on the market. Beginning February 2011, all products that aren't covered by an exemption-ordered license are off the market. And that's where people are fearing that there's going to be things disappearing from shelves. I actually wanted to talk to our local health food store to find out which percentage this fellow has. He's got a great business in the beach, but I didn't get around to talking to him. So I'm not sure if it's a real or mythical problem right now. But I do know that I looked at some of the Health Canada policies, and at least their stated position is that they respect the fact that natural health products are often created by small businesses. It's a policy of the government to support small businesses. They're trying to streamline the regulations to help small businesses get them through more easily. That's their stated position. Whether that's fiction and the reality is different, maybe someone who actually has been through the process would know. But that's the reality. So when you look at Bill C-36 and the hype over it, what really concerned me is I saw some emails where people were saying, we've got to be complaining to our MPs about Bill C-36 because they're going to be pulling foods off the shelves soon. I was chomping at the bit. It wasn't a chat line in which I should interfere because it wasn't our chat line. But the thing that concerned me is if you go to your MP and say, Bill C-36, they're going to pull stuff off the shelf, the MP will go to his clerk or someone in his research assistant and say, is this true? And the research assistant will look at Bill C-36 and say, no, it says they're exempt. They don't know what they're talking about. And you'll be shut down. You'll never get the person's attention again. Know what it is that you're concerned with. So if it's natural health products, it's national health product regulations. And that's what you should be, looking into, informing yourself of, at least right now, and lobbying about, not Bill C-36.
Is there still opportunity to lobby? Not really.
Bill C-36?
Not Bill C-36, no. But the
natural health product. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the interesting thing. The Food and Drugs Act is a federal statute that regulates all foods and all drugs in Canada. And like we do in Canada, basically says you can sell nothing except this. I mean, we start by banning everything, then we create little categories where it slips through.
We don't really have buyer beware.
It's kind of the Canadian way, peace, order, and good government, and all of that. Well, when natural health products started really entering the marketplace, they were concerned because without regulation, they didn't know if these things contained, let's face it, rat droppings and arsenic are natural. They're not healthy. They're natural. So they didn't know what was in these things. So they thought that they have to start regulating them. The only act they had was the Food and Drugs Act. To amend the Food and Drugs Act means it's an act of Parliament. Now, it took 3 sessions to get Bill C-36 through, which was just consumer protection of lawn darts and things like that. They didn't think they could get it through Parliament, so they created a new regulatory regime. So they just basically created a new fictional category in the regs called natural health products and administratively created rules for it. So the answer is, yes, it's not too late to lobby because it's not an act of Parliament. Natural health policy, their regulations, they can always be changed. I keep banging this table.
Okay.
I feel strongly about this. They can be changed. It's worth voicing your opinion on them. The other interesting thing about it is the committee that regulates all this, I looked at the membership, and I, you know, as a paranoid person, I was expecting to see Big Pharma all over the place. And you know what? There was some Chinese medical practitioners. There's some naturopaths. There's a homeopath. There was a couple of researchers at universities. The committee in charge of policy actually was a not bad reflection of the at least the regulated health community and all of its modalities and all of its diversity. There's some dietitians. They actually are trying to put it together. I think their bias is still far too pharmaceutical, you know, for our tastes. But, I think there are ears that would listen, and I think it is worth, you know, expressing opinions on.
I think the big thing is just what you've hit upon is that we all were under this misconception that this was Bill C-36.
Right.
And that it's done. But because it's a policy, you're saying we should rally the troops and see what we can...
If there's a risk, and as I said, I didn't get a chance to talk to or to call the retail council who, you know, for natural health product retail is to see if there is a real problem or not, or if the backlog's been taken care of. Because that's the other thing. Between the exemption orders and the licenses, what percentage are not going to be on the market? I don't know, but it might be quite small.
Well, now, how does it affect... U.S. manufacturers sending us product, us being Canadians.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You cannot sell a product that does not have an exemption order or license. So if you're, and that means whether it's imported. So if you get something sent to you from a foreign country that hasn't been reviewed by the food and drugs people, if it's for your personal consumption,
yes,
it'll go under the radar and no one will know. But if you're going to turn around and sell it to your clients, you're violating the natural health product regulations and therefore the act itself. And you could be charged. Certainly they could seize and take away your inventory and cause you economic loss.
Mm-hmm.
Probably what they would do is this. They would call you up and say, we heard that. Is this true? Yes, it is. Stop now. Yes, I will. End of story. They don't want to waste money on you. That's what will happen. And if you say, yes, I will, and you don't, then they will send an inspector. Then they will start seizing, and then they'll get nasty. But their first shot across the bow will always be voluntary compliance because it makes their paperwork easy as well as yours.
It's just so much better product in the U.S., I have to say.
Yeah. Well, you know, then encourage the manufacturer to comply or become an importer and get involved yourself.
There's a lot of paperwork, is my understanding.
Yeah, there is. Mm-hmm. There is. But
we're such a small market. They'll just not bother with us.
One of the other policies I've read is that they're changing the thrust to make it less pharmaceutical. So they're trying to do what they call risk-based assessment, which is the first question is, at first blush, does the product contain any risky substances? You know, it's a sleep aid and it's chamomile. The answer, no. It'll be fast-tracked. They're claiming it'll be fast-tracked through. If it's something that's not so, then you may have a problem.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean,
I'm thinking about something even as easy as like vitamin D, where, you know, we have a mandate like it's 1,000 IUs, where in the U.S. the minimum is like 2,000 IUs. I mean, this is Canada.
Yeah.
I think that it would be reversed, that we could have 2,000 IUs as a minimum, and the U.S. would have 1,000, right?
Yeah, I hear you.
It's ridiculous to me to try to comprehend that personally, right?
Yeah. So, And that is one of the problems with Canada. Yeah, Health Canada set a 1,000 limit, and they don't want to see over 1,000 because they've decided that's the toxicity that is reasonable for a Canadian.
Right.
And you're right. And if you bring that in for your personal use, you'll go under the radar screen, although the importation of that is probably a violation, but you'll get away with it. But if you sell it to your clients, you're breaching the act. And I personally would recommend against it.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
So what if it's in a U.S.-based company and the products are coming in from the U.S.-based company and they're being sold in the clinics? Do they have to have...
Well, the clinic would be the ones who are breaching the act then because they're the retailer.
Right. But if the nutritionists are part of that clinical setting and they're basically recommending these supplements.
Yeah, it doesn't change the analysis. It's U.S.-based. That's not the problem. The problem is that if it's not licensed or subject to an exemption order after February, it cannot be sold here. It cannot be lawfully sold. Whoever's doing the selling is breaching the act.
Even though it might be the nutritionist in the actual clinic themselves.
Yeah, it doesn't matter who it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what if you have, like, and honestly, there are supplements like that. If you have vitamin D, but it's 5,000 IUs that are coming from the States, and people recommend that, you'd be...
Same answer. Yeah, 1,000 is the max here. And so, you know, it would... And in fact, it's funny, Beth had mentioned to me, you know, Marigold Natural Pharmacy, and, you know, that might be a question. And I have the Health Canada bulletin on it, and one of the products that they confiscated was Bueno Bone. Therapy contains higher than we recommend, than the recommended non-prescription daily dose of vitamin D, i.e. 1,000 units. So that's the non-prescription. So Canada, we have a different threshold. You know, in the States is, you know, got to love the Americans, man. It's the place of extremes, right? And they cannot regulate down there because it's, man, it's a difficult society to regulate. So when they try to impose these, you know, more substantial regulations, they had a revolt. But Canadians are more polite. Natural health product means a substance set out in Schedule 1, which won't help you. But basically, that's anything organic. Or a combination of substances in which the medicinal ingredients are substances set out in Schedule 1, meaning it's organic, or homeopathic medicine or traditional medicine that is manufactured and sold and used for the diagnosis, treatment, mitigation, prevention of disease, disorder, abnormal physical state, symptoms in humans. So if it's organic and it's used for any of those purposes, restoring or correcting organic function or modifying organic functions in humans, such as modifying those functions in a manner that maintains or promotes health. So if it's an organic substance that is used to, you know, maintain and that modifies your function for promoting health, it's a natural health product. Now, the good news is they also have, this is so fascinating to get into, classifications of products at the food natural health product interface, meaning products and food formats. So they have a whole policy about the difficulty that you have a nutrition bar. Is it a natural health product that's regulated, or is it a granola treat that is a food? How do they make that decision? So they actually have a policy manual that you can get that will tell you how they do that. And, you know, God love them. It's common sense. You know, if it looks like a food and smells like a food, it's a food kind of thing, right? So and they won't say an apple. They're not going to say water becomes a natural health product because it cures dehydration, because water's always been... is it a food? I'll say it's a food.
What about this?
That would be a natural health product, most definitely.
And they have a they probably have an exemption.
You mentioned homeopathics?
Homeopathic remedies are considered natural health products, yes.
Okay, so
but they have their own subcategory of regulation.
Okay, so even if they're coming, they're truly potent.
Don't bring it in. For the purpose of this guidance document, a food purpose means a purpose that has been established by history of use or by being regulated, defined, or implied as following a novel food notification. So basically, if it's always been a food, it is a food. And some of the things they look at is whether or not there's recommended dosages. So if you have, you know, like Red Bull, I don't know how they get Red Bull in the market. To me, it would be a natural health product, wouldn't it? I mean, it's using caffeine as a stimulant or something like that. No, but it's using caffeine, which is a natural substance, as a stimulant. It's not a good one.
Right, true.
But it is one, I would think.
Caffeine's okay, but
vitamin
D. But ginseng. But the fact if it has a dosage recommendation, it's, you know, it's a bar, but you know, no more than three of them in any 24-hour period, they would say, you know, recommend a dosage one every 6 hours. They would say that's an indication, not definitive, but that's an indication it's a natural health product and not a food, a granola bar. And they look at these different things. Have we always called it a food? You know, garlic. Garlic has certain medicinal properties. But we've always called garlic a food. They're not going to label it a natural health product.
Even if it's in a pill form?
Well, that's where it's no longer in its natural state. Then it might. Then they'll look at it and say, no, a pill is a pill is a pill. That's not a natural food.
Come on.
Well.
Based on its potency.
You know, But, you can be, I understand what you're saying. But on the other hand, there are certain things that are fat soluble and can build up in your system and be quite toxic. And they only know if something is or isn't doing that if they have a right to look at it. And they only can have a right to look at it by regulating it. If they don't regulate it, they have no right to look at it, and you can sell vitamin A capsules. I think vitamin A does build up in the fatty tissue, doesn't it? It can be quite damaging. Yeah. Canada certainly is at the high regulatory end, but I would say that's not unusual for our, you know, our great country. We tend to love to regulate and have royal commissions look at things and makes everyone feel busy. But I'm sorry, I'm a little cynical on this. But it is what it is, I guess.
Is this anything to do with codex?
With what?
Codex.
I don't know. Yeah.
Products without a license or valid exception number, does that also mean DIN number? Does that mean...
No, I think identification number.
Yeah.
No, DIN number is something different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. A license and an exemption is something issued by, is it Food Canada? Is that their name? Health Canada. In the regulation of natural health products. It's like a license for the food. It's like the license for the product. And you cannot, after February, you cannot sell it here unless you have their stamp of approval. That's separate from DIN.
So even if it's coming from the States, they got to go through Health Canada to get that stamp of approval?
Yes. Coming from Germany, coming from anywhere, manufactured here. And part of what they do is also they control the environment of manufacturing. That's one of the, and I mean, as Canadians, we should be actually kind of happy about that. At least I am, because I sometimes look at products coming in from certain countries and I think, geez, I wonder about the sanitary environment in which this was made, you know? And one of the goals is in the regulation is, I don't want to sound like too much of an advocate of it, I'm just meaning that all regulation is not always all bad. And one of their goals is making sure that natural health products, like all food products, are manufactured in a relatively sanitary environment with proper quality controls. Mm-hmm. So when you're buying goji berries from somewhere, it's actually, you know, it's properly put together.
I guess the big problem is, from what I've heard, is it's very expensive to get a number. There's a big backlog.
Yes.
And that, you know, we're going to have problems with stuff coming in from the United States, and they're not going to bother.
Yes.
Because we're just such an insignificant market.
Yeah. Yeah, potentially. You know, I don't know the answer to that. On the other hand, maybe that's a great opportunity for Canadian entrepreneurs to fill that gap.
Well, I mean, it's even some of the, like, our large, you know, natural product manufacturers, like, say, Metagenics or Biotics, right, where they have almost, like, one product for Canada, and then they have a different product for the U.S. And a lot of it, like, even, you know, some of their cleansing products where they have, you know, the potency of, say, like, glutathione, and the product is much better. I would much rather use a U.S. product than I would the Canadian product for efficacy, but we can't have it, we can't get it. I mean, they'll tell you that, right?
Well, you know, one of the recommendations that the committee I mentioned before has made to Health Canada is that they make life easy by recognizing certain jurisdictions as safe jurisdictions. Kind of saying, they may do it differently, but let's face it, a Swede lives longer than a Canadian. They got to be doing something right. So if you can sell it in Sweden, you know, sell it in Canada. And you know, United States and Germany. And there's sort of
scientific.
No, but seriously, but even within Health Canada, there is a group that's saying, come on, let's not create ridiculous paperwork here. If it's if it's a country whose laws we respect and whose standards are scientifically, you know, proven and based, why worry about 500 IUs one way or the other? If they're not killing Germans, they're not going to kill Canadians, right?
Is there a group doing this?
Well, that's one of the recommendations that went from this committee to Health Canada. I haven't heard that it's been implemented yet, but they're aware of the problem, and you know, that's where, again, I would say lobbying might be a very good thing. That's something you'd want to pick up as a community. And I can give you I don't have it with me tonight, but I can show you the recommendation list that I saw.
Could even get some of the manufacturers like Biotics and Metagenics involved in this as well, because it must be painstakingly difficult for them as well, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's not there. It's not there yet. There are problems. They're aware of the problems. They're trying to move on the problems. They say, but then again, it could all be optics too, right? You know, they do have a slightly more regulatory philosophical perspective than probably the people in this room would want to see.
Okay.
Is there anything else anybody wants to touch upon while we're here?
As if I were to operate my business out of my own home,
yes,
and it's various services besides nutrition consultation, I don't have to be licensed by the city to be able to do so.
Are you in the city of Toronto?
Yeah.
Yes, you do. If you're going to provide nutritional advice of any nature to members of the public from your house, you technically require a license from the City of Toronto because your house is a holistic center, and they will not give it to you because you are not a member of a regulated profession. So your only choice is to practice under the radar screen, hoping that no one will complain. There is an exemption for educational purposes.
Well, that's an exception. It's not defined.
It's not defined, but it's interesting. I mean, they do say, for example, that like teaching piano is an educational activity, right? But you know, maybe I should have mentioned that qualification. I'm discussing it, you think, in the context of you providing nutritional advice.
Yeah.
Having a paying client come to your house and working with them as a nutritional consultant is not an educational purpose.
Yeah, but you're providing...
You've got an argument, but I think you would lose the argument. At the end of the day, if no one complains, you never have a problem. And if they do, you're in an argument.
Can I put signage outside my door?
No, gosh, no. No outdoor signage, no outdoor activities. There are zoning bylaws for each of the former boroughs and cities that amalgamated to form Toronto. And they've been in place ever, you know, all these different zoning bylaws for their regions. So you have to comply with the zoning of the old city. So if you live in East York, you have to comply with the old city of East York zoning bylaws. If you live in the old city of Toronto, the old city of Toronto. And they may be very different. Okay? Part one. Last year, the city passed amalgamated zoning bylaws that replace all the city bylaws, all the individual city ones. And they passed that at council. So we have new zoning bylaws that are amalgamated, and that's what I've been speaking to today. Point two. Point three, the new zoning bylaws, which were passed by City Council, are not enforced right now because they're under appeal. So the City of Toronto is still enforcing the old city bylaws. But because they think the new ones will survive the appeal, they're going to enforce the bylaws that are not enforced. So really, we have to comply with both. So what does it mean to enforce bylaws that are not in force? I think what it really means is they're going to hold you to the strictest standard in either set, and if you wanted to battle them, you might win on the basis that you can't enforce bylaws that aren't in force. But on the other hand, most of us don't want to hire lawyers and battle them and all that, you know, so that's why I took the recommendation here, go with the most conservative approach. If you're carrying on a holistic practice of a non-regulated profession in the City of Toronto, do it under don't tell them about it, you know, do it under the radar screen. If you're in a residential, and you'll be fine. If they get any complaints, that's when they'll enforce and they'll ask you to cease and desist.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Appreciate it.